week of October 6th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 464, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Belasco Theater on Broadway, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, you must be there, at the Belasco Theater, that is, to see The Irishman, and I don't mean the Broadway play and or musical based on the Martin Scorsese film, which has yet to be released, based on probably some book that he based it on. You're there to see the Netflix movie.
That's right. They can't get into AMC and Regal. Well, by God, they'll go to Broadway. Netflix has booked the Belasco Theater for a month. It's dark right now. That was where Network with Bryan Cranston was playing. And in the spring, or the winter, I think, actually, the musical based on Bob Dylan's song called Girl from the North Country will be playing there. So it's dark right now. And they stepped in and said, hey, for the month of November, from November 1st to December 1st, let's show a movie. And they're putting on The Irishman at the Belasco. Scorsese thinks it's cool. You know, it gets to have a sort of a movie palace, the way people saw movies in the old days. They're going to have a state-of-the-art screen and sound system installed for the display. There won't be popcorn, but for a month you can see the Martin Scorsese film The Irishman on Broadway, and tickets will just be $15. So you know what, that's cheaper than a lot of Broadway in movie houses.
Well, a couple things here. This is a great idea. This is a phenomenal idea. You're basically taking a movie that you think is special and you're making it even more special by doing something that is an event.
It's a cute little PR thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I want to actually fly to New York and see this.
Well, I wouldn't, because you'd probably get better seats and comfort seeing it in a movie theater, to be honest.
Okay. Well, that's probably
true,
actually.
And the bathrooms at Broadway houses, they're small and they're not a lot of them. So this is a 3-hour and 20-minute movie. It's fun. I've seen movies at Radio City Music Hall. I've seen movies at Lincoln Center. It's a blast. I'm sure it will be fun. But this is not necessarily the ideal way to see a movie. But it's fun. Good idea.
Well, certainly acoustically, it's probably not. You're right.
Well, now, let me ask Broadway you this. Houses have good acoustics, generally.
Let me ask you this. Why can't you eat popcorn at the Belasco Theater when you're watching The Irishman?
They don't have popcorn machines. What are you talking about?
Well, they can bring those in.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
Oh, all right.
But our show is happening. Oh, well, our show is happening because you are back from Brazil. How was your trip? What was the convention?
It was Expo Cine, and I have to say, when I was there at Expo Cine, which is kind of like a CinemaCon, but for South America and Latin America, so everything Mexico on down, Argentina, Colombia, Uruguay, Bolivia, Brazil. I'm not going to mention all the countries.
You.
It's in Brazil, though. And I was sitting there eating my, believe it or not, a piece of chocolate cake, which was the only thing I ate that day. And Luisa Favel, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, and that it's not Favelli. It could be Favali. Her name is Luisa. She works for Glaz Entertainment, and I hope it's not Glaz Entertainment. I should have actually asked all of these things when I was speaking with her. But she came up and said, "Are you Sperling Reich?" And I thought, "Who? What?
Are you the police?"
Who wants to know? And she was a listener of Showbiz Sandbox.
Oh,
all the way in Brazil.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, that's
and
very
she
fun.
Even knew about our missing episode when we had that one missing episode.
How the heck did she know what you looked like from the photo online?
Yes, which, by the way, I said, "Oh my gosh, that's pretty remarkable because that's a pretty old photo." And Luisa said, "Yeah, I know," which means we should probably update our website at some point with a photo that looks a little bit more like us.
Oh, that's awesome that she's listening. And we do have listeners all over the world listening to the podcast. What are they going to hear about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we will definitely... Oh, gosh. Apparently, the Joker is trying to take over our podcast the way he's taking over the box office. The new film starring Joaquin Phoenix set box office records all over the world last week. Is the movie dangerous? Is it an Oscar hopeful? One thing we do know, it's a hit. In China, the country celebrated National Day by heading to the movies in Beijing and heading to protests in Hong Kong. We'll check out the big winners at the box office and keep our fingers crossed for safety of protesters in Hong Kong. On Inside Baseball, talent agency Endeavor prepared to launch its initial public offering and then, at the last minute, took its ball and went home. You see what we did there? Because it's Inside Baseball. Mm-hmm. And we said something with the ball.
Keep going.
So, yeah, okay. With this and the recent elections at the Writers Guild, is there a stronger incentive than ever for agencies to start taking seriously the demands of their one-time clients, i.e. the writers. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office, which is why Michael has a big surprise for us.
I do?
You do.
Well, we've got 2 weeks of box office worldwide. You'll find a chart for the week of September 29th. That's when Downton Abbey was still ruling the roost at $46 million a week ago. This week, however, we've got a new chart. We've got a link to Comscore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Deadline, The Numbers, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. You, our listeners, from Brazil to Australia. And the number one movie around the world is... not the Joker. It is My People, My Country, a Chinese anthology drama. It's celebrating part of China's National Day, which took place on October 1st. That's when the country was nationalized. It grossed $286 million worldwide. The film is an anthology. It's a bunch of shorts celebrating the country. Chen Cage is one of the big name directors that's involved in it.
What, you mean Shang-Kai-Gu?
Oh, thank you very much. Wow, did I ruin that one. Shang-Kai-Gu, is that how you say it?
Yeah, Shang-Kai-Gu.
All right, well, thank you very much. $286 million worldwide. In fact, it's at number 11 on the North American charts. And an Indian film, War, is at number 9. So it's a great week for international movies at the North American box office. But worldwide, it grossed $286 million. Now, until a few minutes ago, we thought the number 2 movie around the world was another Chinese film called The Captain. That grossed $242 million last week. So these movies opened up on Monday, which was National Day in China, a big national holiday, and they made tons of money. However, The Joker made a ton of money too, and over the last few minutes, the finals have come in. They keep bumping up the box office, 80 to 85 to 90 to 96. The worldwide box office jumped up. So it jumped up about another $15 million. And that means Joker, the Warner Brothers flick starring Joaquin Phoenix, grossed $247 million worldwide last week. That's mostly from Thursday onward. Those other two movies, of course, opened up on Monday, but hey, we're looking at the whole week. But Warner Brothers has a big win with Joker. We think the budget is around $70 million, so it's already profitable from its opening weekend alone. Pretty darn good for such a risky film. It won a top prize at Venice. It's an Oscar hopeful. Thank God no violence broke out during the movie's release. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But this is a big, big win for Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I would say so, especially leading into it. You had a lot of media talking about, there was, in my opinion, like a drummed up controversy here. There was no reason for this movie to be controversial.
Well, there were some phoned in threats.
Okay.
You also had the families of one of the shootings that take place daily. And I mean that literally in America. We just had another mass shooting yesterday. But literally on average, there's a mass shooting in the United States every single day. That means a shooting in which 4 or more people are wounded or killed. So we had the families of one group that was involved in that calling on Warner Brothers to boycott politicians and not support politicians who won't fight for gun safety, calling on them to donate their money and put their marketing and PR muscle behind that in Washington. So that was an issue they had to deal with. Then there was a potential threat of violence. You know, any Yahoo can call any local station and suddenly you have to say, oh, well, what's going on here? So you're walking down Broadway and there are cops outside movie theaters, which you normally don't see. So, they took it seriously.
Yeah, I didn't drive by any theaters that had police officers outside them, but then,
you were in Brazil. You were waking up to the sounds of samba and enjoying your coffee and smelling the smoke of the Amazon on fire in the distance, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't think I didn't notice any
Well, good.
Smoke.
Well, good.
That's good.
So, big movies from China at number 1 and number 3. The Joker is at number 2 around the world. A big win for Warner Brothers. We'll talk more about that, of course. And at number 4 is The Climbers, another Chinese film. This one stars Jackie Chan. It's about the true story, I think, from 1960, where climbers climbed a very difficult side of Mount Everest, a more challenging approach to the top. That movie made $100 million last week. So another strong win, though obviously The Captain, which is sort of a... their version of the, what's his name? Sully? the pilot who had that special landing in New York City. There was a pilot who was very brave and helped avert a crisis, and that story is told in the film The Captain.
So wait a second, did you know, Sully is based on a true story of a pilot.
Yeah, and this is a true story as well.
Landed on the Hudson River.
Right, and this is a true story about a pilot who averted a disaster in China.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yes. So, My People, My Country is number one with $286 million worldwide. Do we believe that number?
There's always question. One thing I learned in Brazil was something I already knew, which is, there's the whole world minus China when it comes to the movies, because there's no way to actually get information in and out of China. You can't find any information out about digital cinema devices there.
Well, except through the government.
Yes, you can, right. Through the government, but they'll only give it to you piecemeal. And when it comes to box office, everybody kind of shrugs and goes, well, maybe it made that much money. You know, who knows? We just kind of have to accept whatever they tell us.
Right. So there is an asterisk by all Chinese box office, though we figure with a Hollywood movie, they're less likely to play games. They're certainly not going to inflate box office totals for Hollywood, because then they're responsible for handing over more money.
That's right.
So they might downplay a Hollywood film. But their own movies, again, they have My People, My Country making $286 million, and they have the Jackie Chan film The Climbers, also released on National Day, also a patriotic movie, what are those types of movies called?
Propaganda?
Yes. Well, sure, but there's a nicer phrase for it, melody movies, right? Main melody movies, movies that strike that main melody of how wonderful the People's Republic of China is, which was, of course, founded on October 1st, 1949. So there's no particular reason why The Climbers would make less than half the amount of My People, My Country, or maybe somebody decided that's the one we want to support the most. We do know sometimes some movies, people are given tickets and told they must go to the box office to see it, typically a very tiresome government propaganda film a la like a real documentary that's just boring and pablum, that sort of thing, not commercial movies like these. So they may be inflating the numbers a little bit, but we're pretty confident that a lot of people went to see this movie. Heck, they went in the U.S. It's number 11 in the country. That's pretty darn good. I mean, it didn't make a lot of money in North America, but it did reach number 11 at the box office. It grossed almost $1 million in North America. That's pretty impressive. And certainly nobody was, goose-stepped to the movie theaters here. The Indian film War made $1.5 million in North America. It's at $2 million and counting. So, these movies are striking a chord around the world. In China, we just assume that these are the best numbers we can get and that they have some strong relationship to reality. We just don't know, and there's no way to double-check.
That is right.
Yeah.
And, I know that
we don't want to tiresomely say, as far as we know, every single week, but that's the reality.
Correct.
Okay. So China's My People, My Country is number one around the world. Joker is number two. The Captain is number three, that other Chinese drama about a pilot. And at number four is The Climbers, another reality-based Chinese film about people climbing Mount Everest. At number five around the world is a movie that opened up last week. It's the Universal animated film Abominable. It made $45 million this week. It's at $76 million and counting. And we were talking last week, we would have mentioned that Jill Colton is the first woman with sole writing and directing credit on a big budget Hollywood animated film. I don't usually like to make all those sort of qualifications, but it's so rare for a woman to have sole writing and directing credit on any movie. The fact that she's the first woman to do it with a big Hollywood movie that's animated is well worth pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there have been female directors and writers on animated films
almost
before.
Almost always co-directing.
Correct, yes. Yeah. And by the way, animated films, even when it's men, there's often co-directors, co-writers, because it takes a lot of work to direct these films.
They're not always co-directed, though, but it's more often you'll see that with a woman that they rarely have sole directing credit. So there are plenty of men who have sole directing credit on animated films, though there are teams as well. Like you say, it's not quite as uncommon, but this is very notable. But you can go right back to one of the first animated films. That's The Adventures of Prince Ahmed from 1926. The German director Lotte Renninger, she wrote and directed that movie. It's the oldest surviving animated film, and it uses a silhouette animation technique, sort of like shadow puppetry. She does cutouts and then moves them around. It's really beautiful and delightful. It's often on TCM. So one of the early pioneers in filmmaking was also a woman on an animated film, and now Jill Colton Carlton is following in her footsteps. So
well,
that's...
even like if you look at Up, okay, just a classic example. Pete Docter gets credit for directing that movie.
Right. Sole credit.
Sole credit. However, also credited on that movie is Bob Peterson. He gets second credit. In fact, he gets a second card.
Right.
So it was directed by Pete Docter, co-directed by Bob Peterson.
Right.
It,
it's a lot of effort to make an animated movie. So congrats
to
Jill.
There's a lot of moving parts.
At number six is Downton Abbey. The number one movie last week made $28 million this week. It's at $135 million worldwide. We still don't know what this movie costs to make.
What, Downton Abbey?
Yeah, we don't know the budget. I've not seen a reference to that anywhere.
Well, they had to build a whole castle, so a whole giant mansion. So it must be very expensive.
Well, also quite expensive is War. That's the Indian drama we've already mentioned a couple times. It's an action film, actually. It's at number 9 in North America. It's at number 7 worldwide. It cost $28 million to make, and it made $24 million this week. I believe it set an opening day record in India. So it's off to a big start, but it needs to make a lot of money to become profitable, but it's on its way. And number 8 is Ad Astra, or as some friends who saw it said, Sad Astra. This is the Brad Pitt film about a guy in space. $22 million it made this week. It's at $111 million worldwide. This will probably be put in the loss column, but there are some people who think it's good. At number 9 is It, Chapter 2. $19 million it made last week. It's at $436 million worldwide. And I feel like it's losing steam and it's already in a lot of territories. I think this one may not match the original, which is what we kind of expected, that it would end up at about $700 million worldwide. I don't know if it's going to get there. It's in 79 territories right now, so that may fall a little bit short. But of course, taken together, these two movies are hugely profitable. It costs $90 million to make, so it's already, you know, comfortably in the black. And number 10 is Rambo Last Blood, which looks like it'll be the last film in the Rambo series, at least starring Sylvester Stallone. Someday they'll probably reboot it. It made $18 million last week. It's at $74 million worldwide. Hustlers with J-Lo, that's at $15 million this week. It's at $110 million worldwide. Some more really good news. Jumping down to number 13 is Judy. That's the Renee Zellweger film in which she stars as Judy Garland. It jumped quickly from like 400 screens to 1,400 screens in North America. And I thought, they are pushing this too far, too fast. But it worked. It's higher up on the charts. It made $7 million this week. It's at $10 million and counting. I don't know the budget for this film, but this, as an art film, this looks like this is doing gangbusters.
Yeah, I mean, $10 million so far. Yeah, it's doing well.
Yeah, and it's going to have a long season with, you know, Oscar hopeful talk, and Renee Zellweger will be nominated for Best Actress. Adult audiences turn out slowly. So unlike Downton Abbey, you know, they didn't show up opening weekend necessarily for all the people who want to see it. They're going to show up in the next few weeks. So this movie is going to have long legs. And funnily enough, I just came back from New Jersey last night where I saw Chasing Rainbows, The Road to Oz, which is a new musical about the early days of Judy Garland. This show tells the story of her as Frances Gum and the early days in vaudeville till she gets into MGM, makes some Andy Hardy movies, and then finally gets that big break and gets to star as the lead in The Wizard of Oz. So this musical, which could well jump to Broadway. It was a good show. It's in good shape. This one leads up to her early days, and then Judy, of course, finishes with her end days. So you could have Renee Zellweger triumphing at the Oscars, and this show could be, you know, a player in the Tony Awards.
Well, and, you know, here in the United States and North America, it's being distributed by Roadside Attractions, if I'm not mistaken, which is... you know, that's pretty good for them to be making this much money with a film.
Right. And I'm sure it was made for a price. This is not a lavish, elaborate
Correct.
Film. So it's a period piece, and Renee Zellweger's a star, but I'm sure that it was made smartly. Jumping down, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is at $363 million worldwide. And Gemini Man, the much-anticipated Ang Lee film starring Will Smith and Will Smith, that opened up in some other territories. That made $7 million last week. The reviews have been poor, both for the storyline in the movie and the 3D and high frame rate presentation of the film. I think you checked it out, didn't you, Sperling?
I did. I did see Gemini Man.
And?
You know, I did see Gemini Man. yeah, you know, look, the story is what it is. It's not horrible, but it's not, you know, overwhelmingly...
I mean, you watch the trailer, and it takes them like 5 minutes to... So you made a man out of another man. I'm like, A clone. Just say clone. Like, what is... They're acting like this is the most impossible thing to describe, and it takes them forever to... And you're like, it's a clone. We get it. We've heard of clones before.
As for the 3D, some of it is very, very good because, you know, it is Ang Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He knows how to do 3D, that's for sure. The high frame rate is the high frame rate. And if you saw The Hobbit in high frame rate, it is better than that, which isn't saying much.
No.
If you saw Billy Lynn, it's better than that. Again, not saying much.
All right, here's my question.
It's very hard to do high frame rate. It does look totally different. It takes a while for your eye to get used to it. For action scenes, it works. For other scenes, it's really hard.
All right. Avatar is a terrible movie, but people went to see it because the 3D was so good. It was just an event. It was worth... I wanted to check it out just to see the technical elements because they were good. I don't want to see them when they're bad. So do you tell me I should see this movie because the technical stuff is done well enough that I'm going to enjoy just seeing that? Or is it not really worth the bother?
It's not for the high frame rate. No.
Well, I don't like 3D. Is it so exciting 3D, groundbreaking 3D that I got to check it out and go, wow.
Oh, no. It's just that it's done right.
Fine. Yeah. So yeah. No reason to check it out for the technical reasons, just the movie itself. And that's not very good.
Yeah. And, you know, the first scene in which, you know, because Will Smith basically is playing opposite himself.
Right. It's more de-aging, just like The Irishman. Yeah.
Correct. And the first time, you can really tell. But then the scenes get much better as the movie progresses in terms of, like, the technology behind it. It is... You can see where the technology is headed, and at some point, you will be able to do this and not tell the difference.
Well, heck, I couldn't tell the difference on The Parent Trap. All right.
Well, that's because there were two people.
No. It's the same actress.
Yes, but didn't they, like, you know... It was the actual actress... And they just shot the scene
yeah,
twice.
Yeah, I'm just saying, but she was shared scenes together with herself.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Dora and the Lost City of Gold, that is at $110 million worldwide, and it still has Germany, Japan, and Brazil to come. It's still not scheduled for China, so this might just pull it out and get to $150 million worldwide. And then there's Man of Men. This is a Korean comedy. It looks like a comic spin on The Untouchables, that movie about two men who bond. One guy is forced to become an attendant and nurse of sorts to a man who is physically challenged and in a wheelchair. In this case, he finds out if the guy dies, he could get a lot of money from the will, so they start doing crazy, nutty things together. But ha! Hilarity ensues.
You know, I'm just going to go back to Ad Astra for a second. They did do, and they being at this point Fox, they did it was definitely out there and in your face. I mean, there was a lot of publicity for it.
Yeah.
I do wonder if the move over to Disney, where they lost a lot of their distribution team and a lot of their PR team, I wonder if that kind of hamstrung that release just a bit.
Well, why would you wonder? Because it's a movie with mixed to poor reviews. Its only success is with cineasts, I would say. It's not like some guys are like, yeah, it's fun. You know, this is a movie that is appealing mostly to cineasts. And Brad Pitt is a star, but he doesn't open a ton of movies. It's not like he's an automatic box office draw. He's certainly a name. He's in a big success right now with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it's got poor reviews, a murky plot, it's not poppy, it's just more of an art film, and it's not that successful as an art film because its reviews are quite mixed. So isn't it kind of doing what you should do, given all that information?
Well, when you put it that way.
Well, now the Joker is what we really want to talk about. It's not the Joker, but just Joker. This movie really has set records.
Yes, everybody thought, I don't know why everybody's so surprised. I guess they didn't expect it to do $93 million. I expected it to do between 70 and 85. I knew it was going to be big.
Yes. But it's a bold film. It's not a poppy, fun film. It is a serious film. It's more like people reference Taxi Driver. They're not referencing The Dark Knight or, you know, some other film that's comic book and poppy and fun, but has sort of a dark overtone. They're referencing Taxi Driver. That's not a movie that packs them into the movie theaters. So, you know, it won the Venice Award. But again, Venice is not known for launching big popular films. That tells you it's a serious Oscar contender, but it doesn't tell you this is a movie that the masses are going to embrace. But
no, and I almost wonder, this, it's kind of underscores the state of the Hollywood film industry. And I kind of point that out because... Here you have a guy, Todd Phillips, who's made a lot of comedies that people like, you know, Old School and Hangover, and they're very, you know, successful, and he wants to make a dramatic film featuring, you know, a mentally ill character, and he's got to do it through a comic book. He's got to actually cast a comic book character to do it, because you could never make a movie about Travis Bickle like Taxi Driver today without at least Hollywood wouldn't make that movie.
Really?
I don't think, no.
Well, I mean, that's how this movie came about. He said, I want to make a film about mental illness. And they said, well, only way you could do it is by making it about the Joker.
He wanted to make a film that was more serious.
Right, but, The Dark Knight is serious. I mean, there are serious comic book movies. I don't understand. You're making it sound like it's a trick to make a serious movie. Yeah, there's all types of superhero movies. There's deadly serious ones. There's light silly ones. There's ones that are mixed, wholesome and heartwarming ones. You know, this one is a dark one. Just like westerns. There are comic westerns. There are fun westerns. There are action adventure westerns. And there are deadly serious westerns like The Searchers. So it's a genre that can accommodate all types of styles. And comic book movies are the same.
You know, my daughters were kind
of... Well, good God, you didn't take your daughters to it, surely.
No. But they were... No, gosh, no. They were kind of having a conversation and asking me, you know, which Joker costume do I like better? Which Joker... Okay. Do I like the kind that are... Where the makeup is sewn on, you know, like the Heath Ledger kind of, or do I like it where it's painted on? And I thought to myself, why am I having this conversation with my 14-year-old daughter?
That's the reach of marketing. And that's why Joker, I keep wanting to say the Joker, it set a record for October in North America, not for a comic book movie, not for an R-rated film, but a record pure for an October opening. It also set an October opening worldwide record. It's the biggest opening movie worldwide of all time. That record, of course, will fall pretty quickly because more and more movies keep opening worldwide in more and more territories. For Warner Brothers, it's their biggest hit in 2 years. The last time they had a movie open this big was It, Chapter One, back in 2017.
Well, and it's got major Oscar buzz, as you point out. You know, it won the Venice Film Festival. Everybody is hailing Joaquin Phoenix. They might not be hailing the movie. You know, the movie really has divided people.
Well, there's been a mini backlash. You know, the reviews out of Venice were pretty ecstatic. Now that it's being seen by more people are like, you know what? Some people think it's dangerous. They say this movie is irresponsible. Others say it's too empty-headed to be irresponsible. You know, it's not that important a movie. Is just, you know, playing with these ideas and tropes, and it's too empty-headed to get worried about. But there was concern about violence. There was heightened security at theaters around the country, and you could see that here in New York City, and I'm sure other major cities around the country, they really took it seriously, as you have to do when you get some thing. And as we mentioned before, families reeling from gun violence pressed Warner Brothers. They used the opening of this movie to say, hey, you are sending money to politicians who encourage gun violence. Why don't you stop supporting them? Why don't you start supporting politicians who support gun safety the way the vast majority of Americans do? And the studio sort of, thank you very much for your input. You know, they sort of sidestepped that and said, well, we're always concerned about gun safety. I like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He's always good. He has a column in The Hollywood Reporter where he felt the families, you know, he of course has empathy for them, supports their cause in general, but feels like they were wrong to sort of focus on this movie in that way. He felt like they were implying this movie or any movie creates gun violence, or that this movie would be to blame if there was more gun violence. You know, the movie is free speech. It's tackling this issue. Whether you agree with how well it tackles it or not, it's a serious attempt to do that. And so he feels like the implicit boycott of the movie and targeting of the film is not the way to go. That's, you know, this is separate from the very real battle that they are waging.
Yeah, well, and if there was a boycott on this film, you'd never know it.
Well, no, they did not call for a boycott. They absolutely publicly and specifically did not say, but the implicit threat was, if you don't, you know, make nice with us, we might call for a boycott and that might hurt your movie. But they never did that. They didn't.
So what you're saying, there was no quid pro quo?
Oh, good Lord. So my
question... It'd be a shame if something happened to nice comic book movie.
My question is... well, that's kind of what Kareem's point, Mr. Abdul-Jabbar's point was, that you were sort of holding the movie hostage to your political goals, and that kind of really shouldn't be. If you object to a movie, say you object to a movie. That's fine. But to say, hey, we might rally against your film if you don't support our cause, he didn't feel that was the smartest way to go. But this movie is a big commercial hit. It will be an Oscar player. Whether it's too dark for Oscar voters, of course, we'll find out in January whenever the nominations are announced. This has got to be a big win for Warner Brothers, but is this a big win for their DC universe?
I wonder, because it's really not being seen as a DC universe film.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like they're going to bring this character back and have him play up against Batman. That's not happening, right? They've already
may not even
do a sequel to it, right?
Well, I don't know whether they'll do a sequel to it. I think that based on the way this movie was handled, this is not a movie that is being set up as a franchise.
Right. No, that's certainly not how they want to spin it right now. That's not the intent, to have lots of fun Joker movies, because it's much darker than that. So it really feels like a one-off they can't build on. But it does help them in one way. It's gotten some very good reviews, and it tells filmmakers, hey, we may support you if you want to be bold and edgy and do something different, whether it's even the wacky stuff of what's his name? The guy doing Marvel movies?
Taika Waititi?
Yes, whether you want to do that or you want to do something dark or, hey, we can help you deliver a good movie. And that's been rare, few, and far between for Warner Brothers and their DC movies.
Well, keep in mind, this is Todd Phillips, by the way,
yeah.
Former classmate of mine. I think he might be doing a little better than me,
yes.
than the entertainment business. But that said, this is Todd Phillips working and directing a film for Warner Brothers, for which he has made a mint. He has made them a fortune through those Hangover movies.
Yeah.
So this was, I don't want to say payback, but this is a way of saying,
you've got a director who's delivered for you repeatedly, then they want to try something different. You have every reason to say, okay, within a reasonable budget, we'll give you a shot. That's not, it's not like, all right, fine, we'll let you make this movie. It's like they took a gamble and it paid off great. They took a gamble with him on The Hangover. That paid off great.
That's true.
Yeah. So I don't think it's.
Well, less of a gamble with The Hangover, but still.
Well, it's hardly a given that it was going to be a big hit film. They let him direct a big movie.
Yeah, well, he had directed big movies before.
Not that big, I don't know. I mean,
old school.
Yeah, that's not a big movie, right? $30 million budget or something? None of those are big budget movies. But yeah, he delivers for them. They let him make more movies. And then he says, I want to make a drama. And they say, okay, let's keep it within a reasonable budget. And then you can. Plus, they hedge their bets by saying, let's base it on a really famous intellectual property, Joker. Once they found a property that he was ready to do, they said, well, Joker gives you a fair amount of comfort, right? Hey, this is not like there were two movies being made about Joker at the same time at one point, right? People were racing to make a movie about Joker, an origin story about this character. So, there was reason to think, this is a commercial gamble, and it paid off.
Well, okay, a little aside. There I am in Brazil. I land, I get an Uber, and the Uber driver takes me for a ride. And I mean that literally and figuratively. You'd think that that's not possible, but it's possible. I guess he wanted to up the fare. So he said, I can't go directly into the city because it's a rotary day. They have certain rules about which cars can drive in the center of the city. So I have to take an alternate route. Well, this person's alternate route went around the city, literally, like just the big, there were farms, and I was like, where are we?
How much was your final tally?
It would have been $50, but I wrote to Uber and they said, yeah, okay, bad on us. And they put it back to the original quote. But the reason I mention all of this is because there I am, we're out in the middle of nowhere. There's favelas to the left, fields to the right, horses, cows, and there's a guy, we're on a freeway, there's a guy riding a bicycle on the shoulder of the road. I thought, that's really odd. You would never see that. I've never seen that in the U.S. on a freeway where a guy is allowed to ride a bicycle on it. And as we are zipping past him at 55 miles per hour, he's wearing a clown face. It was just the oddest. I was like, oh my God. It was so ordinary. Like, yeah, of course. Yeah. Guy riding a bicycle on a freeway and he's wearing a clown face.
I think favelas by definition occur mostly in urban areas, but that's okay.
Okay. Well,
and there you go. But that's no big deal that you got that wrong. You're learning about a new culture every day.
That's true. Oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
I see what you did there. You said the word culture, and you also said the word big and deal together, so it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Okay, so here's our first story. Another big project facing delays and heartache is the Museum of Motion Pictures. Although, isn't it like the Museum of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences? This is the long overdue celebration of movies that is slowly but surely being built by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. But with more cost overruns and agita than the filming of Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, well, the Academy, I'm sure, would prefer we reference some other lengthy shoot like, I don't know, James Cameron's Titanic. That was long and lengthy and actually turned into a huge hit. We shall see. But they did take one big step last week. The Academy hired a new head of the museum and its fundraiser extraordinaire, Bill Kramer. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. Of course, they needed a new head. And it seems to be saying, you know what, we're going to worry about the artistic vision of this museum later, or we don't want to rethink what we're already doing, because that's not his area of strength, as I understand it, that he's known as an administrator and organizer, not a guy who's going to come in and say, you know what, let's rethink this. Which could happen.
I think here's the deal. They could save a lot of money. And here's why. I have gotten at least 10 invites to the Academy, okay, over the past 2 years. 10 invites to the Academy. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put the word museum at the end of that. 10 invites to the Academy Museum, because I get these things in the mail, okay, and I'm like, oh my God, I have been waiting for this my whole life. It says, your invitation to the Academy. I like rip it open. And then it says that I could be a founding member of the Academy Museum. And I'm like, oh, they got me again.
They could save money by taking you off their mailing list because you are not about to fork over $100,000.
Yeah, I'm like, come on. For Pete's sakes, I thought I finally got my invitation to the Academy. No, I got my invitation to the Academy Museum.
and to hand them money.
Yes, correct.
Oh, well.
So maybe Spider-Man will be the new Iron Man after all. Sony apparently had second thoughts about its Spider-Man franchise. They accepted Disney's offer to fund 25% of the next Spider-Man movie in exchange for 25% of the profits. Also, Spidey will appear in one more Avengers film, all of them produced by Kevin Feige. Spidey fans can heave a huge sigh of relief that all the planning to make Spider-Man shoulder the burden of the Avengers can either happen or be resolved in a satisfying way. And who do they have to thank? Actor Tom Holland, apparently, who campaigned for everyone to talk it out and make it happen. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I don't know. It's the safest plan, I guess. I think it's kind of a big whoop. It's cool that Tom Holland stepped in and made it happen. That was interesting. I still don't think it's necessarily a good deal for Sony. You know, why do they need to give them a 25% of their most successful property that they have in their entire studio system? But, you know, let's not rock the boat. Let's just, you know, take the easy way out and make sure everybody's happy. Keep the same director, keep the same star, keep the same producer, keep the same relationships. And you know what? This is not an ongoing thing. It seemed very specifically that they would have one more movie, meaning a trilogy, and he would appear in one Marvel film. That's all that's guaranteed. And since for the next 2 years there are no Marvel Avenger films, of course, there aren't. I'm not sure what movie they would plop him into. It could be Black Panther. It could be one of the new launches that they have. I'm not sure where they would use him, but it feels more like they'll be able to wind up the storylines that they have rather than make this an ongoing relationship.
Well, and I think what would be nice is if, Disney says, okay, look, we're going to be intermingling our characters here. Here's some characters from Marvel that you can put into a Spider-Man film. I guess they did do that with Samuel L. Jackson, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so if they continue to do that and put in a few more characters, you know, then Sony's getting its money's worth.
That's, You mean having those people, having Jon Favreau pop in and all that?
Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, I don't know how important that is to Spidey. Spidey's been successful from day one, you know.
Yeah, he's the most famous, you know, arguably the most famous Marvel character, along with.
No, he is. I think full stop.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I was gonna throw in a couple X-Men. All right.
Fantastic Four, X-Men. Yeah, but you know, single character Spidey.
All right. Well, maybe we need somebody to measure it for us, like Nielsen. The TV audience measuring service, they announced big changes. The company was overhauling how it measures eyeballs, and finally they were going to include out-of-home viewers, like people at bars or college students watching Stephen Colbert in a commons room. Do they do that now, or do they just look at their phones? They probably just look. Anyway, the big change was set to begin last Friday, Instead of the overnight numbers first thing, Nielsen would reveal its new numbers at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time instead of, you know, like first thing in the morning. Then they said, hey, it's the first day, so maybe the numbers will be ready at like 12, okay? Not 11 a.m.
No, maybe 12, maybe 12.
Yeah, maybe 12. And by 12, two. How does two look to you? Because, it was a big fat fiasco, and the advertisers and studios and networks were not necessarily pleased. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? It's opening day. It's, it's they face planted. That's not good. You don't want to do that. But, you know, come a week, a month from now, that will be forgotten.
Totally agree with you.
As long as the measuring service works, you know, but not a good look, but it doesn't matter long term. If it happens again and again and again, of course, then you got a problem.
In the U.S., music acts hate windows. They, you know, every house they build, no windows at all.
No.
Oh, okay, you mean the act of making a new song or album exclusive to a certain streamer only to fans that pay a premium price? That's what they hate? Well, as far as they're concerned, this just pisses off the fans who hear a new album is out and then can't listen to it on their streaming music provider of choice. But in China, the streaming service Tencent is discovering that windowing is driving fans to upgrade to a paid premium level and increasing its revenue. With U.S. streamers desperate to increase revenue, will the old practice of windowing become the shiny new thing for them to try? Meanwhile, Spotify is pushing podcasts more and more on its listeners, and the numbers show that it's working. I know this is actually subliminally to get me to make sure that we're on Spotify. Fewer people are listening to music, and of course that means Spotify gets a captive audience but doesn't have to fork over royalties to record labels. When folks spend time listening to fun content like, I don't know, off the top of my head, I'd have to go with, Showbiz Sandbox, actually. Maybe that's one reason Spotify is pulling back from all sorts of playlist potential. They're downgrading the presence of playlist curators and dismaying labels by a decreased focus on playlists supporting global music, dancehall, Caribbean, and other non-US and UK music that often gets short shrift. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, there's a lot going on here. Number one, Tencent finding success with windowing is a big deal because I think U.S. labels are going to start to copy that. They say, hey, you know, the streamers are going to say, you know what? We need a new revenue stream. We're having trouble with royalties and all this stuff, and they keep wanting more and more money. If this can help us, they're going to try it out. I don't like
now, it. Now, imagine this, okay? Mm-hmm. Keeping in mind, okay, in the back of your mind, Netflix, HBO,
right, they all have exclusive Apple. Content.
They all have exclusive content, but they all got their start by having content that everybody else had or but they basically didn't produce that content.
Right.
Okay.
But we're used to streaming services, and it's totally different than, you know, we'd be furious if we had to subscribe to a Warner Brothers Music streaming service and a Columbia or Sony Music streaming service and a Universal one just to get all the music we want. We would find that really annoying. We're used to, like the radio, all the music is available on all streaming services. It's not fair or right, but that's what we're used to, and that's what we want, and I'm scared that that's going to change. So I think that's a big deal. Spotify pushing podcasts, that is a big deal. It helps them lower the amount of money they have to fork over to record labels. And so they have every intent, they have every incentive to do that. But their downgrading of world music and all these genres that they were helping to champion, that's a real shame to see.
You know, I have to say, I love the fact that on Spotify, if I hear a great jazz song, mm-hmm. Or need to look up some classical music. It's hard to look up classical music, by the way,
yeah.
because of the way it's named.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's hard, but that's more of a search thing. But I can always find it on Spotify. I'm always like, oh, that jazz, and there it is. And sometimes there's like two or three albums that feature that particular artist and song. It's great.
Well, there's a lot of jazz and classical that is not on the streaming services
yet.
That
is actually true as well.
There's a lot of music that isn't there, but for recent stuff, they're just tremendous.
Well, thank you, Jay-Z. That's the feeling from the NFL, which has Jay-Z to thank for lifting a cloud of shame that was hanging over its Super Bowl halftime show. Football players are getting sick and dying due to the long-term effects from playing the game. Players who dare speak their mind on politics are being ousted, and yes, we're looking at you, Colin Kaepernick, major pop stars, including Jay-Z, said they would not want to be associated with the NFL. And then Jay-Z decided it would be kind of fun and cool to own a team, so he made nice with his fellow multimillionaires, and all was forgiven. 5 minutes later, Jennifer Lopez casually mentioned in an interview what an honor it would be to perform the halftime show. Her husband, although I don't know if they're married yet, so fiancé maybe? I don't know. Baseball player turned face of baseball on Fox, Alex Rodriguez, smiled adoringly. And 5 minutes after that, Jennifer Lopez will be performing the halftime show alongside Shakira. Hips don't lie, and neither does money. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, I am just astonished by this story because everybody covered it. And I swear to God, I don't think a single outlet mentioned the fact that last year, this was hugely controversial. People were thinking, oh my God, they're going to have trouble booking acts. You know, we talked about it, but a lot of people talked about it. This was a red hot political topic. This year, J-Lo says, oh yeah, I'll do the halftime show. And nobody asks her questions or challenges it. Nobody mentions the controversy in the last year or two surrounding the NFL and how major pop stars were walking in the opposite direction saying, no way am I going to do the halftime show. It's as if that whole controversy never happened. They have the memory of like 2 minutes. It was very frustrating to me.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at that myself. You know, the first couple stories mentioned it, but then it was just like, that was it.
I saw Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Deadline, Billboard. I saw nary a peep about the idea that her doing the halftime show might be controversial, or Jay-Z and his getting in with them and how that gives covered. I mean, there was nothing. It was as if that whole, all the politics and all the sensitivity around this issue disappeared. And, you know, it's been a while since J-Lo's had a hit. But that's okay.
That
she's got plenty of classic tracks to put together a big extravaganza, and she's got the hit film Hustlers to make her seem current. So, you know, I don't think she's a poor choice for the halftime show. She can put on a spectacle. She's not a major star in my mind in terms of pop songs, but she's got 13 top 10 hits, and Shakira will be there, and, you know, it'll have a Miami vibe, and they'll bring in some other acts too. So it'll be fine as terms of a show, but in terms of politics, I am shocked.
You know, her, you know, she lives in Hidden Hills, which is nearby where I live.
Yeah, and she's hanging with A-Rod, so I shouldn't be surprised by anything she does.
Yeah, her kids went to the same, you know, our kids went to the same preschool. And when she would show up, oh my God, it was like, it was interesting, to say the least. You know, I don't know why we didn't put these two stories together, because we need to talk about Windows again.
Okay.
Apple sees the value in releasing its movies theatrically. So thank you, Apple. The new streamer is fully embracing a 90-day window for movies it wants to release in theaters. Now you might ask why. Apple sees a big plus in being part of the conversation of the cultural impact of a movie playing in theaters, and they want that for their films. First up, Sofia Coppola, you know, the Coppola daughter, On the Rocks, and A24 will be releasing that for Apple, which will be given a classic 90-day window for theatrical distribution, so not the 30-day window that Netflix has. Apparently, they'll be following the Amazon model, giving a full window to some films and short windows for most others. That's the case for the film Hala. Is it Hala? Hala?
I don't know.
And Anthony Mackie's The Banker and the documentary The Elephant Queen, all of which will hit theaters this fall before debuting on Apple TV a few weeks or about a month later. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, for one movie, they said, okay, we'll go the whole hog. But for a lot of the others, we'll be like Amazon and just sort of, you know, pick and choose and do whatever makes sense for us.
Well, and I guess really, here's where it matters. If you want a wide release, then yeah, you got to go whole hog 90-day window. But if you're doing a documentary and you know what, the people that are going to show this, the exhibitors that are going to show this,
they're indie already. A lot of them are indie already.
They don't mind because they know, you know, the people that are going to go see it are going to go see movies in their theater anyway, because of how they program their theaters.
But I liked it when the AMCs and the Regals had documentaries in the mix on their 20 screens. So I'm bummed if that means less and less of those movies will play in that theater, because I like that mix. I like seeing Bollywood films. I like seeing documentaries at the big chains. I think it's good to expose people, because those indies, the ones that you're talking about handling documentaries, those are mostly in urban centers, you know, and the Angelicas of the world, the IFCs. So it's not reaching the heartland the way a documentary playing at AMC can.
Correct. Yes.
So that's a shame.
Although what the argument there would be, well, Apple TV will reach the heartland, and so it might be seen by more people than it would be if it was just showing at AMC.
Mm-hmm. I messed up this next story. I forgot to write the copy for it, but here's what's happened. Disney fired Catherine Powell. She is one of the, she oversaw, I should say, the U.S. and Paris theme parks for the Walt Disney Company, and she got kicked out after the launch of Star Wars Galaxy's Edge fell flat. She'd been in charge of Disneyland Paris, Walt Disney World, and Disneyland. She was also in her post during the openings for two new Star Wars lands, not just Galaxy's Edge at Walt Disney World, but another one also in California Disneyland, and both fell flat on attendance. And Disney was not happy about that, and she got the cold shaft. And it just really doesn't make sense. I feel like they really pulled the trigger too far. For one thing, Galaxy's Edge opened up months earlier than expected. In some worlds, that would be seen as a good thing. Hey, we got it up and running. We're ready. We beat the deadline. They opened it up. But you know what? Not all the rides are available in the Star Wars world that they have opened up. And a lot of people, they plan their vacation like a year. And they can't just suddenly say, oh, we'll show up a month or two early to check out Galaxy's Edge, especially when they're waiting for all the rides to be opened up. You know,
well, and I can tell you that, you know, Disney, look, I'm in Los Angeles, so Disneyland is down in Anaheim. It's not that far away. Mm-hmm. And there has been talk amongst, you know, the people that go to Disneyland on a regular basis that, yeah, it's definitely less crowded. And the feeling is everybody thinks that everyone is going to rush to Galaxy's Edge right away. So let's avoid it for now. Let's wait a year, then go.
Well, but then they also opened up 3 months early. So that, I mean, even if you plan to go right at the start, that was in, you know, months later than they actually opened up. So, you know, people can't just take a vacation on the turn of a dime. You know, that's a complicated, expensive choice. A lot of people, they go to Disney World or Disneyland once or twice in their entire life. Plus,
yes, right.
Next year, Disney has a huge 50th anniversary for Disney World. It opened up on October 1st of 1971. So in 2021, they've got big plans for that. So also a lot of fans who might say, well, do I want to go this year? I think I'll wait till next year because I know they're going to have a lot of stuff going on for the 50th anniversary. Plus, all the Star Wars rides will be opened up by then. They're not all opened up yet. So when you open up early, when you know that not every ride is open yet, so the full experience isn't available. When you know you've got huge landmark anniversaries coming up a year ahead for at least Disney World in Orlando, and when you know your audience makes their plans a long time in advance, the idea that people didn't jump on opening weekend in basically what we're talking about for Galaxy's Edge is really an overreaction, I think. I think it's a real shame to her. I don't know whether what great or poor job she did, but, you know, let's wait a year and see where you're at. That's a theme park. That's not something that happens on day one. So I really think that was an unfair decision. It's a shame that they did it. But in looking up this story, I did find out that there are vegan options on offer at every food location at every U.S. theme park in the Disney World, including like the Tatooine Two Suns hummus at the Star Wars sites. So isn't that crazy? But vegan is even coming to Disney World.
Oh, what would Walt say?
He'd say, if it makes money, I'm happy. And I should thank our longtime listeners, Michael and Rosie Ortega-Napoli, for passing the vegan story on to me. When I was researching the Star Wars Galaxy Edge story, they gave me some helpful insights about why this was an overreaction and why it was dumb of them to act like it's been a disaster just because of its opening few weeks' attendance.
You know, it's funny because my daughters love going to Disneyland.
Sure.
And they said, like, it's totally like the California Adventureland across the way, totally empty because everybody's over at Galaxy's Edge. And then you go over to the Disney park and it's not nearly as crowded as it used to be because, you know, it's kind of like a couple years ago, they had to take down a bridge over a big freeway here in Los Angeles, and they called it Carmageddon because they had to close the freeway.
Right.
And they warned everybody, don't drive this weekend. Don't drive. It's going to be horrible. Literally, nobody was on the roads. It was the greatest thing ever because everybody thought, if you get on the roads, you're going to be stuck in traffic for days. But nobody went.
Well, there's no long-term trend that Disney World or Disneyland are falling drastically in attendance. So that's not the case. It was specifically lands in this parks. So yeah, there's not big long-term problems with attendance at Disney World theme parks. If there were, that would be a reasonable thing to do then, to fire the person in charge.
You know, it's not easy being the New York Times. I mean, literally every comma, every headline, every decision they make is put under a microscope and certain to make someone unhappy. Although, given the fact that they fired all of their copy editors, maybe not every comma. I will say that. Well, here's the thing. Tough. That's the price you pay for being the paper of record, at least here in the U.S. and really the world. They are one of the top papers in the world. One bad decision it made in 2017 was to cut a bunch of bestseller lists detailing the hits in categories like mass market paperbacks and comics. But making those charts is a key factor in creators being able to market their books and themselves. Everyone wants to be able to say they're a New York Times best-selling author. Worse, that decision meant genres like comics, graphic novels, romance, horror, and the like would be all but invisible. Now the Times has rethought its decision and is bringing back the bestseller charts for mass market and comics. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It really matters to the people involved in those genres and those worlds. They're really thrilled to see it come back. I had no idea why they got rid of them in the first place. There's limited room on the printed page in the New York Times. I understand that for charts, and they want to make sure they're visually appealing and easy to read. But online, at least, there was no reason to get rid of them. They still have the info every week, I imagine. So why dump the charts? It was a dumb decision, and I'm glad they've gone back.
Yeah, I agree with you. Look, I mean, the New York Times bestseller list tracks book sales in the U.S., so I get it. However, it is also seen by the world and in the publishing world as, you know, one of the big lists to check out. And when publishers are looking for books to bring to their own country, going to the New York Times bestseller list is one place they go.
Absolutely. And making romance and horror virtually disappear, that's really upsetting because there are big fans of those genres, big authors who aren't going to be making it to the bestseller list purely like Nora Roberts or Danielle Steele. But on the charts for mass market paperbacks, they have a presence there. They have a role to play and they have an audience. And, you know, ignoring them makes them invisible.
Now, we've talked a lot about copyright in the past, mm-hmm. you know. And especially U.S. copyright. Well, here's something that might be affecting the way, you know, what movies you see coming up out of Hollywood soon. An obscure ruling means that after 35 years, the rights to many works can revert back to the creator. This has had a big impact in books and in music, and now it's happening in movies too. It just so happens that it was 1984, some 3.5 decades ago.
35 to 29, you're right.
Yeah. So some big franchises are facing an uncertain future. Writers, producers, and others are raising their hands and saying, that big juicy intellectual property that you got there, yeah, that's mine again. Thank you very much. Among the franchises that might be affected, the Terminator series.
I'll be back.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Patty cake.
That came out in 1988, FYI. Die Hard.
You skipped Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice. Yeah, Die Hard, Predator, Nightmare on Elm Street, works by Stephen King and David Mamet, and more. In some cases, this means studios have an incentive to take one more swing at a franchise while the getting is good. In other cases, where ownership is less clear, Terminator, it means a lengthy court case. But tell me this, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's probably a big whoop. It seems a lot harder for people to reclaim property in the movies, and it's too complicated. You know, it's not like a novel where you can just publish it yourself. So I think it just makes a happy day for the lawyers. But maybe I'm wrong about that. But the reason Roger Rabbit is in this mix is because the novel it's based on came out in 1981. So for copyright reasons, it was copyrighted as a movie starting in 1984, blah, blah, blah. So thank you for pointing out the movie came out in 1988. But Who Censored Roger Rabbit by Gary K. Wolf came out in 1981, and they started obviously to make it a movie 4 years before it was released.
I wonder, is the book, does it track as close to Chinatown as the movie does?
Maybe. But it'll be fun to see what happens with this. You know, the writer, Stephen King, you know, every damn book he's ever made has been turned into a movie or a TV show or miniseries. So that's valuable stuff.
Well, you know, you say it'll be fun to watch what happens with this. We've been watching something, which is the subject of our Inside Baseball segment. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, here is how I believe this story affects you. Two ways. One, you will not be able to buy Endeavor stock. Okay, that's number one. And number two, it means you may not be able, you may not be seeing as much dreck that is made just so that actors and writers and directors work and get a paycheck so that agencies can make money bolstering their bottom line.
Whoa, heavens to Betsy, that's quite the claim. So what are we talking about?
Well, Endeavor, Okay, that's what we're talking about. They were going to IPO, okay? And then at first they were like, we're going to raise $600 million. And then they said, nah, maybe we'll raise $300 million. And then they said, you know what? we're not going to actually go public right now because this is not a good time to go public.
Well, yes. And also the people looking at them were having second thoughts. So yes, it's not a great time for IPOs. WeWork, which is a troubled company that has never been profitable, suddenly people said, now that we look at you, you're a really dumb business. They pulled their planned IPO. Peloton, am I saying that name right?
Is it? Yes, you are.
That's the exercise company that faces massive lawsuits from major record labels because they have pop music incorporated into all their exercise programs and in their machines and stuff. Well, they're facing lawsuits over that, but they decided it would be a good idea to launch their IPO, and that crashed and burned, and they got devalued strongly after their opening numbers. So they really had fell flat on their face. So as Endeavor approached its IPO, Wall Street got less and less excited. They said, you know, it's really not a consistent company. It's not one of those easy companies where you can say quarter to quarter, you can predict what they're going to do. It's Hollywood. Some quarters you do great, some quarters you don't. Some years you do great, and maybe all your big talent has big movies, you know, in 2021 and then nothing again until 2024. So you just, it's not a predictable business. And Endeavor tried to counter that by grabbing parts of all these other businesses like beauty pageants and this and that. But those aren't really fitting all together either. So instead of making it one big smart media company, it sort of makes it this big giant mess that investors, at least, who want to have predictable quarterly results and constant growth from now until the end of time, they all said, I don't know.
Yeah, I am not a big fan of agencies going public, specifically for all of the reasons you mentioned. The fact that it isn't a predictable business. Not all of your clients will be working all of the time. You cannot guarantee that their salaries will always increase or that their value will always increase. Or that, frankly, they'll stay with you.
Hence all the writers who, and of course, they're facing their own lawsuits, aren't they?
Well, yes, with the writers, and who knows when that whole mess with the Writers Guild of America gets settled, if it ever does, the lawsuits might go away. We'll find out.
Yeah.
I know that some of the agencies are saying, "Oh, we're holding talks with the WGA," or the WGA is saying they're holding talks with some of the agencies, and the big agencies are saying, "Yeah, not with us. You're not holding talks with us."
Right. Well, you know, I loved the PR that they pulled the day this all happened. You know, when it fell flat on its face and they suddenly yanked the IPO right before it was going to happen. Not only did they yank it and say, never mind, we're not going to do it. Not only was this, you know, perhaps not a black eye. They're like, no, this is wonderful. Everybody's thrilled. We're all delighted. We've never been stronger than now. And it's like, yeah. The problem is a lot of agents and a lot of people at the agency were getting stock options, you know, pieces of what was going to happen when this company went public. It wasn't mean they were going to cash out the first day it went public, but it did mean all these, you know, illusory ideas of what you might have and what it might be worth were going to finally have a real number. You'd finally found out, okay, I've got this amount of stock. Now it's gone public. Now I know what it's worth right now. So now I can start to think about all this stuff I've been promised as part of my contract. Instead of getting a big pile of cash, I was getting options. Now I know what that's actually worth. And maybe some of it I want to cash out on, or at least I know where I'm at. Well, that's out the window now. So all these people who for the last few years have been playing the waiting game and saying, okay, yeah, I'll take a piece of this. I'll take a piece of that because one day we're going to go public and then I'm going to be, I'm going to hit it big. Well, now suddenly they don't have that anymore. Endeavor says, oh, everybody's thrilled. Everybody's delighted. No, everybody knows this is the right thing to do, but couldn't be happier. Well, we'll have to see what happens 6 months or a year from now. They, of course, say they're going to do it again sometime in the future, but maybe that won't work.
Yeah, I just wish they would not go public. Certainly taking private equity investment, that's a different story. That's a little bit more realistic. But going public and thinking that you're going to increase earnings and revenue quarter after quarter after quarter, it's just unrealistic.
Well, and now this raises the question. First, we had the elections for the Writers Guild, both East and West. And now we have Endeavor's IPO being pulled abruptly at the last minute, which has got them in a little bit of a turmoil. Does this yet again say, hey, you know what? You've got a big looming issue here. You're not in a position of strength. The writers are holding firm. Maybe y'all need to work together and see if there's something, anything you can do to come to some terms, even if it includes radically changing your business, perhaps. You know, is this going to push them to the table? It certainly is not going to delay a resolution. If anything, it should say, hey, you know what? You've got a big looming problem here. And if you ever do want to have a production company, if you ever do want to go public, you need to resolve this one way or the other. Say we're done, or okay, we need to rethink how we do business.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is they're not going to be making the packaging fees because they're not packaging anything with writers because the writers are all gone. So they don't want that to change, but it's changed right now. So they're going to have to at some point sit down and figure it out. Will this, not going public be the reason? Probably. Yeah, it'll just one more thing mm-hmm. that pushes them a little bit. Yeah. But I don't think it's going to be the nail that or
maybe
the
Tom Holland could get them all together. He's adorable.
Yeah, I think actually, you know what? Hold on, let me call Tom Holland right now. That's a great idea.
Well, while you're calling Tom Holland, it's time to move on to the obituary section. A lot of people, of course, die all the time. A lot of people die in the last 2 weeks. Some interesting, some people in areas we don't normally cover. It's a lot of people. I'll try to be a little quick, but they're all kind of fascinating. Actress Diane Carroll died at the age of 84. And of course, the one thing that's on her tombstone right away is the TV show Julia. She was not the first black woman to star in a TV series. A couple women starred as maids in Beulah and some other shows. But essentially, she was the first black actress in a role that wasn't a domestic, starring in her own TV show. In fact, she lived a pretty nice middle-class life for a woman who was a widowed nurse, raising her son and dating other successful black men. It was a top 10 hit the day it opened. It broke down barriers, and that's what I knew her about. That's what I knew her for. But she had a long, rich career. She had 4 Emmy nominations throughout her career. Her film debut was in Carmen Jones opposite Sidney Poitier, who she'd have a tumultuous relationship over 9 years. She made her Broadway debut in Truman Capote's House of Flowers. And then Richard Rodgers wrote a musical specifically for her. He first tried to get her in a musical set in the Flower Drum Song, but she just did not look Asian, even whatever makeup they did. So that didn't work. So he wrote a musical for her called No Strings, and it had an interracial romance, but that wasn't even what the show was about. She was the first woman of color to win the Tony for a leading actress in a musical. So she broke barriers everywhere she went, and then later in her career, she got sick and was stuck at home watching soap operas and said, this stuff is fun. I want to be on Dynasty. And she lobbied Aaron Spelling and says, I want to be wealthy and ruthless. I want to be the first black bitch on television. And so she became Dominique Devereaux. They wrote a role for her and she had a blast on Dynasty and a spinoff. And she had fun right up to the end. So a cool, interesting woman.
Well, and you know my affinity, Michael, for Saul Bass.
Yes.
I love Saul Bass. And he, for those who don't know, Google Saul Bass. He was a graphic designer. He designed posters, movie posters and movie titles for some iconic movies. And when you see his work, you'll be like, oh, yeah, Saul Bass, he's everywhere. He is mimicked to this day. Well, unless you're Saul Bass, you probably aren't well known as a title designer. Wayne Fitzgerald, however, was a huge title designer.
Mm-hmm. A big, big name. He died at the age of 89. And like you say, known by the people in the industry, but nobody else. He had 460 credits on IMDb, including film and TV. Lots of iconic films. You can go to his best stuff on YouTube and check some of them out. And the best work, of course, isn't always for the best movies, but he had really clever work for Pillow Talk, bold work on Bonnie and Clyde, and there are like 1,000 other examples. Apocalypse Now, the TV show The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, Dick Tracy, the Warren Beatty movie Chinatown, Maverick, the TV series with James Garner, The Beverly Hillbillies. It's pity you don't get residuals for doing title designs, do you, the way people do for theme songs?
Let me think about that for a second. No,
yeah,
you do not.
That would be money. He did an Orson Welles film, Touch of Evil. That's a great title design. 9 to 5,
yeah,
The Breakfast Club. And every deal he made, this is how old school he is. It was all done on a handshake. No contract. Never had a contract. That's kind of cool. And we link to an article on the website Art of the Title, which celebrates his work specifically on anti-MAME, but it also touches on his career. So, you know, a very important figure and, a little appreciated part of the industry, but something that really sets the tone for a movie, and that's the title design.
Well, and speaking of people who had some really good graphic art, at least unique graphic art, the Grateful Dead have great graphic art. art, or again, unique graphic art. The lyricist for The Grateful Dead, Robert Hunter, at least one of their lyricists, he died at the age of 78. I'm talking about Robert Hunter.
Yeah, I mean, he was their in-house lyricist, so he did a lot of their biggest work. He met Jerry Garcia at a community theater performance of Damn Yankees in California. Who knew that? But they bonded a week later at a coffee house. They were like 18 and 19 years old at the time. Robert Hunter went to college. He did acid. No surprise there. He sent off lyrics to Jerry Garcia, who said, "Hey, man, come be our lyricist." And he did. He wrote Dark Star, Box of Rain, China Cat Sunflower, Touch of Grey, Ripple. In the song Truckin', he wrote that line that you've probably heard, "What a long, strange trip it's been." And they're great albums where you can see his work flourishing. American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, those are the two key Grateful Dead albums, and two big live albums, Live Dead from 1969 and Europe 1972. You'll find those on all those streaming services, and then you've got an endless world to explore. But he was a key player in one of the most influential bands of all time.
And while you're looking up, Robert Hunter's work, why not also look up Ginger Baker's work? He is a drummer, world renowned. I mean, this, when he passed away, you had everybody from Paul McCartney to Eric Clapton. I mean, everybody was, you know, honoring him. He was a drummer for Cream, Blind Faith, Fela Kuti's Africa.
He played with Fela Kuti's Africa, yeah. 70, played with Charlie Hayden and Art Blakey, even Public Image Limited. So he was in rock and jazz and world. He died at 80, but his big groups were short-lived supergroups, Cream and Blind Faith. They lasted like a New York minute, but they were wildly influential. Rolling Stone magazine listed him as the third greatest rock drummer of all time, behind only John Bonham of Led Zeppelin and Keith Moon of The Who. That's how high up he ranks. Ringo wow. Starr, by the way, was number 14. But he and Jack Bruce in Cream, they fought bitterly. And Jack Bruce had a funny thing when they reunited at one point. He said, "Yeah, you know, we still don't really get along, particularly. He's in on another continent in Africa. And frankly, I think that's a little bit too close."
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, also, you know, we rarely cover executives when they pass away. But Eric Plaskow, he died at the age of 95.
Wow.
He was an executive with United Artists and Orion, okay, two companies. Well, although I guess Orion is making a comeback and so is UA.
I mean, Orion was that company where just for like a decade, you just saw the Orion logo and you thought this is going to be a good movie. They were making really good movies for a strong decade or so. And
I remember, I think one of their last movies was Silence of the Lambs, because didn't Jonathan Demme, he won the award and he said, "It's a shame that this is..." He won the Oscar and said, "It's a shame this, you know, will be Orion's last film, and you know the company's so great," and he went on about the company.
Yeah, well, you know, that's rare that you have people championing a company, but that's what Eric did at both UA and Orion. He really had a great run at the Oscars. He won Best Picture with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Rocky, and Annie Hall. That's 3 years in a row that United Artists won Best Picture. And then Orion, he did it again. Amadeus in 84, Platoon in 86, Dances with Wolves in 1990, and then The Silence of the Lambs, the first horror film or thriller to win the Oscar for Best Picture. That was in 1991.
So you're saying he does not have an eye for a good story. But also, now this is somebody that maybe people in the U.S. know, but everybody around the world will know this person's face. Rip Taylor. He died at the age of 84. He's known as the King of Confetti,
the crying comedian, as Ed Sullivan, yes, called him.
And he must have been in so many TV shows and so many game shows.
Yeah, his website claims he had 2,000 TV credits. You know, Ed Sullivan, Mike Douglas, The Tonight Show. IMDb lists about 200, so maybe that's just puffery, or maybe a lot of his, you know, pop-ins on game shows and talk shows happened before there was good tracking of guest stars like that. But he appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show and then took off. He did everything. He did his own game show, The $1.98 Beauty Show. That was from Chuck Barris, who did The Gong Show. That was a crazy nutty thing. In Vegas, he really found a home. He fronted reviews there for years and won Entertainer of the Year 3 times in a row in the 70s.
Wow.
Super flamboyant, confetti everywhere, crazy character, often mistaken for Rip Torn, a very good actor. but as late as 2008, he was not openly gay. When one writer thought and said that he was like, "You don't know what you're talking about." But his obituaries do mention that he is survived by his longtime partner, Robert Fortney. I'm gay, and you know, I always was sort of conflicted by Rip Taylor. He was this you know, hysterical, over the top, you know, silly, you know, person, sort of a gay step and fetch it, gay Uncle Tom, sort of in a way. You felt like, you know, you could watch TV and never see a gay character, somebody who maybe was a criminal or a villain or a lunatic, or then you would see Rip Taylor. And that was just a coded gay person, but that was all you saw on TV. And I really felt of two minds of it. As the time went on and more gay characters appeared on TV and actors who were gay played straight people and straight people played, and that became commonplace, I could sort of relax a little bit and enjoy his shtick for what it was, just silly, crazy, over the top. When he wasn't the only person there sort of representing gay people, it's a lot easier to take that silly, crazy, nutty stuff. It's like Jack on Will and Grace. As long as you got Will, you can handle Jack. You know, Rip Taylor for a long time was alone on TV. Maybe Paul Lynn, you had him being campy over in some other corners. But I was a little conflicted about him for a lot of years, but eventually grew to accept that he was just, you know, a fun, crazy, nutty personality.
Well, finally, opera star Jessi Norman. She died at the age of 74. And if you don't know who Jessi Norman is, I mean, from Aida to all of her roles, I mean, she is a...
I don't know that. Did she play Aida?
I have a recording of her playing Aida, so oh, good. I hope she played it.
Well, there you are then. Yes, Mexican star Jose also died last week, a big star in his country and around the world. And Jessi Norman, a big star in the opera world. She really broke down barriers, and in a fun way, she really proved black women had every right to be just as imperious and batshit crazy as any white diva. She spoke about herself in the third person. She said, "We are not happy." You know, she was just a character, but also... for the prime years when her voice was at its peak, she was a major, major talent who has done groundbreaking work that'll live forever. She's the first opera star I ever saw in concert back in college in Gainesville, Florida. She came to the University of Florida, and opera singers were not thick on the ground there. I mean, in fact, when a symphony came to Gainesville, people applauded in between the movements of a symphony. That's how little classical music we were exposed to. But she...
Wait a second. You said thick on the ground, yeah, about an opera star.
Oh, well, hey, she was a full-sized yeah, opera star in every possible way. And there she was singing a glorious opera, and she was in peak voice at that time, ending her show with a spiritual that she often did. So that was my first exposure to opera, and a great one at that. She died at the age of 74.
Well, that was the end of Jessi Norman, and this is the end of Showbiz Sandbox, at least this episode. Remember that you can subscribe to us, hopefully on Spotify this week, but definitely in the Apple iTunes, I almost said Apple iTunes Store, but it's actually the Google Play Store, iTunes, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review us. Please do. It does help us out. It helps others find the show when you do that. You can contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that information, as well as all of the stories we talked about on today's show, that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week I can be found at... .com.
Hold on, I'm just... Ha. I think that was like, what, eight ha's?
Eight or nine.
Eight or nine ha's. Okay. You know, if you're finding it hard to read Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.